Well, thank you, John.
Thank you.
Say, not something that I'm used to doing terribly much, these conversations in public, but I'm sure that your experience will carry us through. I actually wanted to begin with the word heroes. Mm-hmm. That one of the first books of yours, I think, that I ever read was the book of that title. Mm-hmm. And something that I've really noticed in reading your work, looking at your documentaries and so on, is the way in which your view of heroes perhaps doesn't accord with the kind of common sense view of who is heroic in our society. So I wonder if you could just talk about perhaps some of the heroes, as you see it, that you've met.
Mm. Well, it's very, very good to be here, and thank you for doing this, Diane, and thank you to Tom Bramble for inviting me. The heroes in that book, and I think have always been my heroes, are people we've never heard of, mostly. They're people who, against the odds, have challenged power imposed on them. They haven't always succeeded, they've sometimes failed, but they've expressed that human spirit that all of us, in the end, those of us who really want to change things in the world, all of us admire. So they're people in Central America, they're people in Central Australia, they're people in Southern Africa, they're people in the developed parts of the developed countries that have stood up against more subtle forms of censorship. So they are ordinary people. They are, I've no doubt, people in this audience who've made a stand in their own lives. I object very strongly to the hero worship of celebrity people. That's not to say that there are names that are well known to us who should be regarded as heroes. Vanunu, the great Israeli dissenter, is a hero of mine. This man who spent 18 years in prison and is still imprisoned, in effect, by the Israelis. A name that has just come to the fore, Mustafa al-Zaidi, the man who threw the shoes. What a hero. What a hero. And when you hear, you read his explanation for doing it, he almost in, I think, probably about 100 words, absolutely demolished all the lies and myths about Iraq and about that invasion. So they're the heroes. Sometimes they're dramatic heroes like him, but they are mostly those people who've tried to make changes in the lives of their societies, be it in Nicaragua or Bolivia or Venezuela or Southern Africa, and in Aboriginal Australia. So it's a very universal application.
Well, let me just get closer to the microphone. Point you perhaps a little bit further towards Aboriginal Australia, because mm-hmm. For one reason is that in the session immediately following this one at Marxism, we will have one of those heroes actually here today.
Yes.
And that's Barbara Shaw, who has, since the beginning of the racist intervention into the Northern Territory Aboriginal communities, despite herself being subject to welfare quarantining and all the other apartheid-type policies, has spoken out from day one, organised, and tried to organise other people to have their voices heard. But I know that one of the areas of the shameful history of Australia that you've brought to light has been the treatment of Aboriginal people, and I wonder if you would say a little bit more about that.
Well, Barbara Shaw is most definitely a hero. I mean, Barbara Shaw, over many years, has fought for her people. She is leading, one of the leaders of these very, very important submissions to the United Nations Committee on Discrimination, which, to the shame of this government and to the elite in this country, has to happen all over again. Whereas it was, 4 years ago that the same committee distinguished Australia as the only developed country to be attacked for its racial discrimination. And here we go again. And Barbara Shaw is one of those who is involved with that. And that's terribly important, because my own view is that the Aboriginal struggle, whilst it continues, of course, at home, has to move outside Australia, has to move into the arena where Indigenous people are now, the arena that Indigenous people and their representatives now occupy. I mean, I think one of the great pieces of good news is the rise of Indigenous people and the rise of their, and the fact that we now hear their voice all over the world. So much to be done, so much for them to do, but they have produced an agenda of their own, and Barbara Shaw and her comrades will be contributing to that. I mean, it leaves one almost speechless to describe this intervention, which is so blatant. You know, the history of Aboriginal Australia in the colonial era has been the history of land grab. That's it in two words, of land grab. And all sorts of misuse and perversions of the law in order to secure that land grab. The most notorious being, of course, Terra Nullius. But even with that overthrown, the Howard government did its best to claw back. And I believe the reason behind this intervention is to claw back what was almost an aberration, that is the granting of land rights in the Northern Territory, the only territory in Australia. Yes, South Australia has them, and they're here and there, and they've been won through native title actions. But the only part of Australia where they were legislated by the federal government is over the one territory that it controls, or then had direct control, and that was the Northern Territory. Northern Territory absolutely brimming in riches, natural riches, minerals and so forth, uranium, and that's, I'm not saying it's directly involved with that, but that's a major part of it. But the point is to get back that one place of Aboriginal gain, significant gain, and that there's no difference between the Howard government and the Rudd government in that. But the intervention has been exposed, in my view, although the Australian public would be forgiven for not knowing this, but has been exposed as the fraud it is. I mean, when you go back to the histrionics of Howard and what was his, the Aboriginal Affairs Minister?
Malbrough.
How could I forget?
He's gone.
He's making money now, isn't he? That's right. Yes, he's gone. Yes, he's a consultant. Thousands, unthinkable numbers, quote unquote, that's what Malbrough used, of child abuse. And last May, when the statistics were released, 7,433 children were examined by doctors. Of those, 39 were referred to the authorities as possible cases of child abuse. Of those, 4 were identified as the victims of child abuse. That's about the national average. Now, in that one microcosm, you have the whole nonsense of the intervention. That's not to say there hasn't been the abuse of children through all the usual mechanisms of abuse, the abuse of poverty, the abuse of trachoma, the abuse of diseases that were stamped out in 19th century Glasgow, the diseases of dirt roads, the diseases of, Thamara, as one community in Northern Territory, gets half the funding that white children get. Those diseases remain in place. And that the Rudd government is pursuing this this outrageous intervention is yet another indication that as long as the elite of white Australia identifies the Aboriginal community as dysfunctional, then they feel they can get away with anything. They're dysfunctional. It doesn't work. We throw money at them. We give them welfare. They're useless. It, you know, they sit in a riverbank. The whole image of Aboriginal people is so distorted, and providing them with yet another vivid image of dysfunction, and that's what the intervention does, then allows the federal governments and state governments and various other vested interests to do as they've always done to the Aboriginal people. We know from some rare reporting in the Fairfax Press and the Sydney Morning Herald several years ago by Deborah Jobson and one other that the Aboriginal people are underfunded, and compared with white people, are underfunded by as much as $300 million, that education gets, as I pointed out in that one community in Northern Territory, something like half of what white children get, that the discrimination at almost all levels is set in stone. And this intervention is a massive distraction, and I only hope that the committee, the United Nations committee, uses at least the strong language that it last used in 2005 to shame Australia in the international community.
You mentioned... You mentioned that great British legal fiction, Terra Nullius, there, and actually one of the recent experiences I had in January this year was seeing wonderful Aboriginal activist Jenny Munro doing a speech at one of the demonstrations protesting against Israel's massacre of the people of Gaza. Mm. And I was speaking to a Lebanese friend of mine afterwards. He'd never seen Jenny speak before, and I thought his summary of her speech was great. He just said, "She was magnificent." And she was. But the connection, obviously, I think, between so many Aboriginal people and the sympathy and solidarity they feel for the Palestinians, that the whole Terra Nullius, or in the Zionist language, the land without people for a people without land, yet another fiction. I wonder if you would perhaps like to move on now to talk a little bit more about the question of Palestine. I re-watched, as I suspect many people did, I re-watched your documentary, Palestine is Still the Issue. As the assault on Gaza, the massacre that took place there, broke out. And in a way, it almost the horrors that I'd seen in your documentary all paled into insignificance by what I was seeing day by day on television as that assault went on. So rather than just talk about perhaps the most recent events, but your long history of solidarity with the Palestinians and, you know, how you feel about the issues going on there.
Well, I first went to Palestine over 40 years ago as a very young reporter. And it was, like a lot of things in those days for me, it was part of my education. I'd gone with, loaded up with all the mythology of brave little Israel. And it's, over a period of time, not immediately, but certainly when I first visited a Palestinian refugee camp, that I think my consciousness was raised almost immediately. The similarity between all indigenous people and the Palestinians are the indigenous people of that part of the world. So the likenesses between the Palestinians and the Aboriginal people are quite exact in many ways. And all the historical dishonesty that has been applied to negating them almost as a people, to destroying their history, is almost interchangeable. If you go back to, let's just go back to 1947, the propaganda then, the early Zionist propaganda, shortly before the creation of the State of Israel, was to deny that the Palestinian people existed. Very similar in this country, even though there they were. I remember going to and staying on what was then called a socialist kibbutz, and there was a socialist Zionist movement. It's become very confused over the years and pretty well died away, I think. But here were all these good people in the kibbutz toiling away and sharing all their produce and sitting down at night and talking about the great European Jewish tradition as it was of opposing tyranny and so on and so forth. And in the distance, you could see these sort of silhouette figures. And I said, well, what about them? A kind of angst immediately set in. These were the Palestinians. These were the Palestinians toiling outside the kibbutz. These were the Palestinians who were actually cleaning the cabins in this socialist experiment, this kibbutz. These were the invisible people. That sort of situation you would have anywhere in the world. In Latin America, the same would be said of indigenous people, say in Ecuador and Bolivia. They were invisible. In fact, they call themselves invisible people still as a kind of ironic mockery. Certainly it's true in Australia. Those who manage to wrench some kind of treaty, however inadequate, out of their various conquistador, such as the Maoris in New Zealand, weren't quite invisible because they had to be dealt with, albeit dealt with in a very manipulative way, but they had to be dealt with. And it was only later, when the Palestinians, having tried to deal on a peaceful basis with the Israelis, it was only later, and that failed, that, of course, the first Intifada began. Israel, this latest assault on Gaza, has nothing to do with Hamas. It has nothing to do with the breaking of ceasefires. It has nothing to do with rockets falling on what used to be Palestine, in towns, what used to be Palestine. It is everything to do what was declared 61 years ago, and that was the cancellation of Palestine's right to exist. We have been beaten over the head with this mantra of Israel's right to exist when the issue is the diametric opposite. It is Palestine's right to exist. 61 years ago, David Ben-Gurion and the various forces of then the incipient Zionist state, such as the Haganah, the Jewish army, and others, set in motion what was called Plan B. And Plan B in 1947 was the destruction of 369 Palestinian villages and the expulsion or the extermination, the ethnic cleansing, and that term was used, of of the population of those villages. They were critical villages. When people fly into Tel Aviv, they fly into an airport that is actually right next to where one of these villages were. The people long expelled, killed, got rid of. The same is true, of course, in Jaffa, which is basically was an Arab city. That plan B has been Israeli policy since. Every war, and that's every war with Egypt, every attack on any country that Israel has mounted, its recent attack on Gaza, has been about taking more land, land grab. It's like our own land grab. They call it creating facts on the ground. And you've seen now in the aftermath of this Gaza assault, the building of these so-called settlements, really more and more of them colonies. That has been the intention, that has been policy. Probably the most significant name for it has been is the Dagon plan. The president head of Mossad is Mir Dagon. Mir Dagon, who was Ari Sharon's number two when Sharon assaulted Lebanon in 1982, devised not a terribly original plan because it was David Ben-Gurion's before that, and that was to, as Jeff Halper recently described it, to warehouse the Palestinian people, to put them in not so much concentration camps, but actually warehouse them, to put them in these enclaves and to ignore them virtually, until they could either be forced to go, persuaded to go, or driven out. They haven't worked out how to actually get rid of them, but the Dagon plan says we hope that we can get them into Jordan. Now, it's gone well beyond apartheid. That is what the assault on Gaza was about. It was to demoralize that society so much. Gaza is the only one holding out, you must remember. Gaza has a government, the most democratically elected government in the Middle East, incidentally. Gaza is the only one holding out. On the West Bank, of course there are people individually and in groups holding out, but they're elected representatives in people like Abbas have really been coerced. So the Dagon plan is to crush this final enclave, if you like, of resistance to them. I think someone described it as an evolving genocide. Whether or not it's genocide, I think, is debatable, but it is certainly brings new meaning to that term ethnic cleansing.
Well, my final... The final thing I wanted to raise, because I can see the audience are all itching to ask their own questions, but the final thing I wanted to raise was, of course, Israel's great and powerful friend, and in particular, the new leadership in the White House, because I remember reading quite a while ago, June or so last year, something that you wrote, which was not at all in line with the general celebrity worship, if you like, of Barack Obama. And I wondered, firstly, why you wrote what you did in the middle of last year when he got the nomination, and secondly, what your opinion is now about the changes, if there are any, brought by the new presidency.
I was invited to speak to the Anarchus annual meeting in London last year, which I very much enjoyed, and we discussed Obama, and I was berated from the audience by somebody for suggesting that Barack Obama wasn't really as he cracked himself up to be, or as the public relations campaign that exists around him made him out to be. And I did note, I think, that it was, I never thought I'd go to an anarchist meeting and find somebody defending the United States president. So we've got a little PR problem here, I think. Barack Obama is another American president, period. And those who invest or choose the opiate of hope render themselves politically impotent. If you go with Obama and the Obama system, or just the present system, the extension of the Bush system, which was an extension of the Clinton system, which was an extension of the Reagan system, and let me tell you, having reported American presidential campaigns for quite a long time, what happens is that the administration that comes in actually adds a layer to what the previous administration does. So, in other words, Clinton added a layer to Reaganite policies. And very much Clinton was the president that brought in a lot of the Reaganite policies, particularly in NAFTA and a lot of the economic policies that have brought the capitalist elite to such a verge of ruin, and of which all these people who were involved with Clinton, are, of course, have been appointed by Obama. So the people who caused all the problem are the people, he says, who are sorting it out. It's you know, Woody Allen said it, when I gave up hope, I felt much better. And that's it. Get over it. Whoever is still wringing their hands that just because there is an African-American as president, there was an African-American woman who was a Secretary of State. One of the nastiest pieces in the Bush administration. I'm sorry, I will go into a long, I hope, kind of erudite idea of why he does this and that, but just get over it. Because those who are drawn into it, as unfortunately much of the American peace movement has, and the whole point of the Barack Obama campaign was to neutralize them, and he's done that. I mean, his great ground force army took orders from above. There was no participation. They have no debts. In fact, you know, the Obama and his people are now saying, the good thing about us is that we have no debts to repay to our supporters. Wow. I mean, is that even in their own terms, democracy? Their supporters gave it all to Obama and asked nothing back. That's not activism. That is not activism. And it's within a couple of months of his inauguration, we have the United States dragging along this dreadful outfit, NATO, and the Brits, and of course Australia running along behind. This hopeless Afghan colonial war. The most reliable estimate of the so-called Taliban, they mean Pashtun control of that country, is 72%. It's over. It's over. But the interesting thing is, among the Pashtun, the dreadful Taliban, the word goes with Al-Qaeda and the devil and all the other things that we're told, we're given constantly on the ABC News or whatever newspaper we pick up, those buzzwords that so deny the truth to us. There was a a very, very comprehensive study done by a newspaper, something of an aberration, the Toronto Globe and Mail, not all that long ago. And they sent people actually in to go and talk to the Taliban. And they found all of them, of course, were Pashtun. Most of them were there because they regarded themselves as Mujahideen, which has a long and proud tradition of getting rid of foreign invaders from Afghanistan. Many of them were there because their families had been killed. Something like one in four had lost a family member in the bombing or whatever attacks on them. A minority of them, a tiny minority, saw themselves part of a global jihad. And very few of them, actually, it seemed, supported Mullah Omar, the so-called leader of the Taliban. In other words, it was basically a people. They certainly believed in an Islamic way of life, and they certainly believed in Sharia law and all those things, but so as Afghanis have been believing in that for a very, very long time. But it was their motivation was against the latest colonial invasion. And there's no question that they would drive the foreigners out of their country. And here you have two countries on the verge of bankruptcy, United States and Britain, the principal parts of this NATO thing, entering into this endless colonial war with the first black Napoleon leading them. You know, telling us all this nonsense in his latest speech. The difference with Napoleon actually won a few battles in the beginning, right? But telling us that we're not going to stand for this in Pakistan, was all Bush's language. It's all nonsense. Pakistan is in a terrible state. It's in a very volatile state. And the American involvement in that country has been, and will be disaster. And this is the can-do man. This is the can-do, yes, we can, administration. I believe that we really have to be informed about those who would impose this rapacious power upon peoples and ourselves and treat it as such. And those who are starry-eyed about it really waste time.
Well, I have to reluctantly hand you over to the audience now, John.
Good.
It's been a privilege to speak to you, even if so briefly. And I have to say that one of the things I really enjoyed was having a reason to reread so much of your writing, to rewatch your documentaries and so on. And I'm sure that many of the audience have themselves done this, but I really recommend this. You want to get your enthusiasm for the struggle, get your feeling that the world really does need to be changed, then I can recommend no finer source than the works of John Pilger.
Thank you. Thank you.